Welcome to the Left of Lansing podcast with your host, Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. A, dare we say, entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how we can best make Michigan's political machine work for the people. And now, live from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another installment of the Left of Lansing podcast, the podcast devoted to highlighting the progressive movement that's helping Michigan become a deep blue state for years to come. After decades of mismanagement by Michigan's conservative forces, Michiganders are saying no to the DeVos family and the Michigan Chamber of Commerce's backwards social and economic agendas. We started to slowly turn around all those wrongs perpetrated by the state's right-wing forces in 2018, but the fight did not and cannot end there, as we, of course, are witnessing right now. Hey, everybody, I'm Pat Johnston. Thanks for coming back for another episode. So much has happened since I've last talked with you, and I'll cover some of that here in just a moment. Hey, I'm excited to tell you that in a bit, I'll be joined by Jody LaMacchia, who's running for the 46th State House District right here in Michigan. It's a seat currently occupied by John Riley, who's a right-wing blowhard who really only wants to emulate his dear leader, which means throwing money to his rich donor base at the expense of the rest of his constituents and destroying Obamacare's Medicaid expansion right here in Michigan, attacking the LGBT community, and more. That's pretty much what he stands for. John Riley, everybody, he is yesterday's news. Jody LaMacchia represents tomorrow's Michigan. Hell, you know what? Actually, she represents today's Michigan. And she'll join me to talk about her run for the 46th State House seat and why she thinks it's important to run in a district that's historically been more to the center right. So I can't wait to talk with her here in just a moment. You can always email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter. That's @leftoflansing. And Left of Lansing is also on the Facebook as well. Governor Gretchen Whitmer stared down her right-wing enemies both inside and outside of Lansing during her stay-at-home orders as we were dealing with this global pandemic. And you know what? Through it all, her stance is being vindicated right now. As of Sunday, June 7th, Michigan's Health Department, according to the Detroit Free Press, reported the lowest single-day deaths due to the coronavirus since March. We're around 59,000 confirmed cases of the virus, while more than 5,600 have perished from it. Michigan was hit hard by the virus, and like every other state, was left on its own to figure out how to combat it. If you recall, the occupant in the White House, as Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley calls him, told us that his administration had a handle on the virus way back in January. He even told us in late February that he expected cases to be at zero in no time at all. That, of course, did not happen. Governors were left with no national plan presented by the White House on how to keep it from spreading out of control. It's killed more than 110,000 Americans, many of them in poor neighborhoods, many of them people of color, many of them black. In Detroit, which is 80% African-American, the virus wreaked havoc. In fact, Ken Coleman from Michigan Advance notes that by mid-April, black Michiganders represented 33% of the COVID-19 cases and 40% of the deaths, even though they make up just 14% of Michigan's entire population. Detroit accounts for Michigan's 1,200 deaths. The virus revealed another ugly side of this nation's inequality in which certain groups of people cannot afford to stay at home. They've got to work somehow, some way, nor can they find adequate health care. By the way, not even can they stay home. They really don't have a choice. If they're told to work, they will work no matter what. COVID-19 revealed the fragility of our so-called great economy. Southeast Michigan bore the brunt of this virus in its first months because that's the most highly populated area in the state. And as it spread in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties, Governor Whitmer had to make the tough call of canceling schools, shutting down businesses, and ordering people to stay home. We didn't exactly know what we were dealing with as this COVID-19 was really starting to spread across the country. All we knew, though, was that it was highly deadly. Now, at first, Michigan's right wing and Republican leadership did not say much. But after the first few weeks, they went after Governor Whitmer by suggesting that she purposely wanted to hurt Michigan's economy. But that's what they said, and it was obvious because she had no win. It was a no-win situation, actually, for Governor Whitmer, because here's the thing. One, she could have said, you know what, I'm going to just keep the state wide open. Yeah, some people are going to die, but I've got to keep the economy rolling. Do you think Michigan's Republican leadership, do you think the Detroit News, do you think the Michigan conservative intelligentsia would have just sat back and said, way to go, Governor Whitmer, way to go. Thumbs up on that one. Yeah, so what? Maybe 50,000 people have to die here in Michigan. So be it. Yeah, sure. Her other choice was to shut things down and try to curb the spread. Those were her two choices. No-win situation. And of course, the Republicans did not let me down, and they didn't let you down, in which they were going to attack her either way. State Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky went so far as to declare that Governor Whitmer's very comfortable being a dictator. Michigan's right-wing Republican Party leadership of Shirky and House Speaker Lee Chatfield followed the commands put forth by the Michigan Chamber of Commerce and its leader, Rich Studley. Michigan Republicans tried to pass bills taking away Governor Whitmer's executive powers to fight against a pandemic, to fight against really a virus that we haven't really dealt with on the likes of it since 1918, so 100 years was the last time we actually had to deal with something on this scale. Naturally, the Republican Party here in Michigan said, no, now's the time we are going to play politics and take those powers away from Governor Whitmer. She, of course, vetoed them. Why? Because Republicans loved it when Republican governors had those powers, but not Democratic governors. They don't like that, and they don't especially like it when female Democratic governors have those executive powers. Michigan Republicans sued, but so far, not one court in Michigan, not one, has decided in favor of Michigan Republicans. A 1945 statute gives the governor the authority to call the shots during times of emergencies. If Republicans had ever wanted to reverse that authority, they had 8 years to do so under Rick Snyder. Instead, they voted to give Snyder more executive power even after Michiganders voted to end the emergency manager rule back in 2012. That's right. Michigan Republicans not only passed a new bill with slightly different language to keep emergency managers, but they also voted in that bill to prevent Michiganders the right to bring that issue back to the ballot again in the future. They took that issue out of our hands, said, no, 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 we know more than you. Was that acting tyrannical? Was that acting against the people's wishes? Nah, that was okay. That was smart government. You know, they thought it was smart policy because it gave the Snyder administration complete control of cities wrecked by the financial crisis of 2008. It gave the Snyder administration complete control of cities that were wrecked by 40 years of Reaganomics. Strangely enough, those cities like Detroit or Flint had high African-American populations. I'm sure it was just a coincidence. And thanks to Michigan Republicans on giving Rick Snyder that power, even though we took that power out of his hands, we got the Flint water crisis. Fast forward to today. Michigan Republicans pretend that their role in the Flint water crisis never existed. Instead, they argue that while many African Americans and other people of color were bearing the brunt of this virus, a virus that, again, their dear leader in the White House said was not a problem a few months ago, they said it was now time for people, poor people, people of color, to serve their base again. Oh, and when the occupant did admit that there was a problem, recall that he told Americans to inject themselves with Clorox or put ultraviolet lights up their butts. But I digress. Now, Michigan Republicans, spurred on by right-wing friends such as the Michigan Chamber of Commerce and others, including the DeVos family, conned some of Dear Leader's cult to storm Lansing a few times and demand their right to be served. To demand their right to plant tomatoes. Remember that? Plant tomatoes. That's right. They demanded their right to a tan. They demanded their right to a tattoo. I mean, they marched into Lansing all angry and waving Confederate flags and brandishing guns. Because when you're battling for your right to plant rosemary and parsley, you must bring guns. It makes perfect sense. And they jammed the streets, honking horns and shouting that they are willing to die for big business. Now, of course, Michigan Republicans didn't point fingers at the occupant in the White House or Senate Republicans in Washington for not doing more to protect small businesses, the very small businesses they claim to care about. No, they wanted you to blame that woman from Michigan. That's all they cared about. That was the end game. And they hoped that it would erode her support and popularity. They decided to play a political game during a global pandemic. But what would you expect from a party that still celebrates a governor whose administration not only poisoned the water of an American city, but then tried to cover it up? That's Michigan's Republican Party. So why should we be so surprised? I mean, that's how the corporate right-wing forces operate here in Michigan and throughout the country. They convinced their followers to die for them, to die for their profits. And the media arm of this movement, Fox News, does this while all its hosts stay at home to report on their fine handiwork. It's great to watch all those reporters on Fox News and all of those personalities say, yes, demand to go back to work, get out in the streets, while they're reporting safe and comfy in their basements. It's strange because here's the thing that never made sense about this argument. If you don't have customers, then what good is it to reopen the state if there are no customers? And don't businesses want as many customers as possible? Couldn't one argue that Whitmer's shelter at home executive order is ensuring businesses will have more customers once this pandemic is over? Even more, couldn't one argue that by saving lives, businesses will have more workers to serve those customers? I mean, this isn't rocket science, is it? But here's the thing, though. I noticed something during those small but hate-filled rallies that were happening in Lansing and happening in other areas around the country. Yes, I, like many of you, noticed the misogyny that many right-wingers were holding for Governor Whitmer. Not surprising. It's the right wing. But there was something else. I didn't see many black people at these rallies. I didn't see many people of color at these rallies. And that spoke volumes to me. And perhaps that's because the virus was tearing apart the black community in higher numbers than other places. It was also tearing apart the Hispanic communities as well. I wondered how Speaker Chatfield or Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey could show little regard on not only who was getting hurt the most by this virus, but who would hurt the most by reopening the economy too quickly. During a state Senate subcommittee hearing, Republican State Senator Kim Lasada defended her dear leader stance that we must force people back to work because, you see, the rest of the state is not Detroit. As Michigan Advance's Heather Donahue reported, she said, this pandemic is not only killing people, the disease isn't killing them. You know, not letting them get back to work and work safely is killing them. I know specifically two individuals who have died from suicide, and I am tired. I am not Detroit, Lasada said. Lasada's short-sighted and selfish statement drew condemnation from many, including Democratic State Senator Adam Hollier of Detroit. Hollier called her statements offensive and frustrating, and on Twitter, Hollier said that she continued her refrain that she wasn't Detroit, as though COVID-19 is just a Detroit issue, as though there was some blame or responsibility on the people who contracted COVID-19 and died from it, that they were doing something wrong, or this was some sort of isolated incident that the state shouldn't be held back for those people. That was Adam Hollier, well said. It's no accident, everyone, you know that. It's no accident that Lasada is using a blatant dog whistle to blame Detroit for everything. That's been the right-wing Republican playbook in Michigan for as long as I've been alive. But this also goes to show how Lasada and the Fox Newsification of the Republican Party view state politics, us versus them. They aren't in Lansing to fix problems. They aren't in Lansing to find ways to make Michigan a place where people want to live. They aren't in Lansing to help people, well, I mean, they're in Lansing to help the good people that Rich Studley in the Michigan Chamber of Commerce tells them to help, I guess. Michigan's Republican Party in Lansing is there to do one thing. It is there to serve those who demand being served. So, when you hear dog whistles like the one used by State Senator Lasada, remember, that's what it's all about. But Michigan Republicans see Southeast Michiganders as them, particularly Democrats. Why should they be responsible for those people? Many of them, people of color. We must blame them for why the state is suffering in this pandemic, a pandemic that Michigan Republicans simultaneously don't really believe is all that bad. Maybe that's because some of them thought the virus was attacking just those people. In the end, they just don't care. They want service, and they want service now. We're sorry for you Michiganders living paycheck to paycheck, but that's why you are here, to serve the donor base. Please, please recall how during these rallies, one state senator, Dale Zorn, wore a Confederate flag mask on the Senate chamber floor, knowing full well what he was signaling to his supporters and knowing full well that he thought he was owning the libs. The Confederate flag waved proudly at these rallies. Proudly. It's a flag that represents sedition. It's a flag that represents slavery. It's a flag that represents anti-Americanism. I just read a piece by Ronald Franklin in the Medium about how General Robert E. Lee's troops, during their march to Gettysburg, kidnapped blacks who were legally freed or who had escaped enslavement. They kidnapped them. And the Confederates then sent the captured to Richmond, Virginia, where they would be purchased for slavery again. Whenever people tell you that the Confederate flag represents Southern heritage, that's the heritage. So those were the forces that Governor Whitmer was against, and she won. She's being vindicated. We've had cases going down, the number of deaths going down, and now she is slowly reopening the state again. I do believe this is an experiment we'll have to see, but she won. We followed her directions, and she won. She was right. Now, in the midst of this pandemic, the images of police brutality against a black man once again went viral. The death of George Floyd by the knee of a Minneapolis cop is one of the more disturbing videos to watch, and it sparked national outrage as protests have sprouted throughout the country. I wondered why this incident felt different than the upsetting videos of Eric Garner's or Philando Castile's deaths. Why was the outrage across the country so much higher than those other videos? And don't get me wrong, there was outrage for those other videos big time. But why does the anger feel so palpable, even more palpable than ever before? I think ProPublica reporter Akilah Johnson nailed it on Twitter. And this is what she said. And I'm just going to read here, if you don't mind. She put a thread up, and I'm going to read some parts of it. She said, "I recently talked with black protesters in D.C. They know about coronavirus. They especially know it's killing black Americans at double the rates of others. It's part of why they're out here. George Floyd was killed by a white police officer who kneeled on his neck for 8 minutes 46 seconds. Graphic video of his death circulated online. Floyd's death, the flame, the pandemic, kindling. Folks said enough is enough. I want to highlight what some have told me. Seeing the life leave Floyd's body was finally the last straw that broke the camel's back for me," said William Smith, age 27. But he also thought about people he knew, a handful of them, who died after catching the new coronavirus. Here's what he said about them. "They were living in impoverished areas, couldn't get proper treatment, lived in crowded conditions, social distancing was too hard to do, and they were still forced to go to work and be put in harm's way. When speaking out against the loss of black lives, protesters told me it is tough to separate those who die at the hands of police from those who die in a pandemic that has laid bare the structural racism baked into the American health system." That was a tweet thread by ProPublica's Akilah Johnson. In a recent NPR poll, it said that 67% said that Donald Trump has mostly increased racial tensions, including 92% of Democrats, 73% of independents, 88% of African Americans, and 63% of whites. Just 18% said he had decreased tensions, including 41% of Republicans. 41% of Republicans. We've heard the occupant in the White House declare Antifa as the real bad guy, even though there's barely any evidence showing Antifa is responsible for some of the rioting that happened a week ago. We've heard the occupant declare that we need law and order. We've heard the occupant blame governors. But you know what? We'll never hear the occupant say. He'll never say police brutality. He'll never utter those words because he needs to keep that right-wing fringe base of his happy. And police brutality against blacks is probably okay with him. Remember, he's never apologized for calling for the death penalty of the Central Park Five, who were all later exonerated. Thankfully, though, we have a deep bench of progressive political leaders in Michigan's legislature, such as State Senators Erica Geis, Adam Hollier, Mallory McMorrow, and Jeff Irwin, to name a few. In fact, Senator Irwin introduced a bill that calls for immediate changes in the training process for police, and it passed in a bipartisan, unanimous way. I can't believe that, but it did in Michigan's legislature. Here's Michigan Advance reporting on that story. It says, a bill requiring all incoming law enforcement officers to complete training on implicit bias, de-escalation techniques, and mental health screening passed unanimously through the GOP-led Senate on Thursday, a rarity for progressive legislation. State Senator Jeff Irwin of Ann Arbor, who introduced Senate Bill 945, said, this is a small step forward in writing years of unlawful police brutality. Training for police officers is one crucial way the legislature can improve policing, specifically for those black and brown Americans who are disproportionately targeted, Irwin said. Bravo, sir. Bravo. You remember when I began this podcast, I said, it's hard work, but we have to slowly start to reverse many, many mistakes of the past here. That's what the Michigan Progressive Movement is doing right now. You see, that's the kind of change that we need here in Michigan. That's why voting to oust the current occupant out of the White House is indeed important. Of course it is. But just as important is making Michigan's state legislature blue. And we can do that by putting people like Jody LaMacchia in the state house this fall. She's my guest, coming up in just a moment. Thanks, as always, for listening to LOL.
It's progressivism with passion. It's the Left of Lansing podcast, where Pat Johnston shines a light on Michigan's progressive movement. Contact Pat at leftoflansing@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Now, back to Pat Johnston.
Sorry about that, but it's been a while since I've done a podcast. I have lots to say. You are listening to Left of Lansing. Thanks for choosing to return, or maybe you're just checking out this podcast for the first time. Regardless, thanks for listening. You can email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com, if you have any comments or concerns, or would simply like to tell me how much this podcast rocks. I'll always respond to those emails, but I will also respond to those emails that aren't as, shall I say, enthusiastic about LOL. Again, you can email me, leftoflansing@gmail.com. This week's guest is someone I've been meaning to talk with for quite some time now. After being politically active, she decided that while getting involved is indeed important, perhaps she could enact faster change in Michigan by actually running for a state representative seat. The seat she's trying to get is currently owned by Republican John Riley in Michigan's 46th State House District. To say flipping the seat from red to blue is vital to help switch the State House from red to blue would be quite the understatement. And I would like to welcome Jody LaMacchia to the Left of Lansing podcast. Jody, thanks for being on. I greatly appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for asking me, Pat. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, first of all, I always welcome having a fellow CMU Chip on the podcast.
Go Chips.
Yeah, that's right. Fire up Chips.
Fire up Chips.
What did you get your degree in, Jody?
Psychology. I got my bachelor's degree from Central in psychology.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. When did you graduate?
I graduated in 1999. Wow, that's a long time ago.
Okay. I think I was 95, so we might have kind of crossed paths. No, maybe not.
No, we did. Maybe. We did, actually. I got there in 1994. I was on the five-year plan. So.
Okay, so was I, actually. But did you go for broadcasting? I know this isn't supposed to be about you, but I had friends that were in the broadcasting department.
Oh, I was in broadcasting. Yep, that's why I got my degree in, and also my master's degree at CMU.
Oh, wow. Okay, so Ryan Hopak was a friend of mine. I don't know if you know him, but he lives in Los Angeles now, and he writes for, like, Jeopardy or something. And also Susie Dahl was her name, but she's the director for NPR or something now, I believe. Not NPR, public broadcasting in East Lansing, so... Anyway, yeah, I had a great time in Mount Pleasant.
You know what? Thanks for mentioning those names. My wife and the technical advisor, as we call her here on the podcast, Dr. Heather, she is the chair of CMU's School of Broadcast and Cinematic Arts. So I will have her.
Wow.
I will make sure that she listens to our interview here, because you just said a couple names, and I'm sure she knows them.
I'm sure as well. Yeah. For sure. Yeah, cool.
Well, anyway, thanks again for being on the 46th District. That is in northern Oakland County, is that correct?
Yes, it's Oxford, Orion, Addison, Brandon, and most of Oakland Township.
Is that around Pine Knob? sorry. I'm sorry. Listen to me. I'm dating myself.
Yeah. No, I think it'll always kind of, you know, be called Pine Knob to most of us that... have been around ever since the concerts were out there and all of that. The DTE is kind of a hard switchover for that. But yeah, it's kind of in that area. But Pine Knob isn't in my district. That is outside of my district, but kind of around there, like north of the Palace, where the Palace was anyway. It's not too far north of it, actually. So right around in that area.
Jody, how would you describe your district? Is it kind of more of a center-right, centrist, center-left, somewhere around that area?
Well, I think most people that you would talk to would say that it's very red, very red. But I don't, you know, I've lived here for 20 years, and I really just don't find that to be the case. I feel like we've always elected Republicans out here because, frankly, we've barely ever even had Democrats on the ballot. There just haven't been Democrats that have really run. Or sometimes, you know, we've had Democrats put their names on the ballot. But I don't think anyone has ever really given it a huge go. The first time that we had someone give it a try was in 2018. She had a very late start and didn't raise a lot of money, but she still gained 10 points on Riley. And I also feel like the district is changing a little bit. There's a lot of different people moving into the district, and there's also just kind of a different vibe. I have a lot of Republicans reaching out to me, you know, wanting to help me flip this seat. You know, I definitely have to have Republicans support in order to flip the seat. And they have contacted me in some cases about wanting to help me or support me. So I feel like even though there might be a lean conservative bent to this district, I don't believe that it is it's not John Riley conservative. You know what I mean? He was the second most, it was last year, he was named the second most conservative state rep in the entire state house. I just think that that's just too extreme. Most of his votes are pretty extreme. And when people see what his voting record is, they are generally, regardless of their political affiliation, they're very perplexed, horrified. I mean, they just don't understand a lot of his votes. And neither do I, frankly. So I don't think it's that conservative. So I do think there's some room for like a centrist Democrat to come in and try to unite the district and not just constantly be creating so much division and so much far right ideology that doesn't really benefit the people of this district or this state.
I'm talking with Jody LaMacchia. She is the Democratic candidate for Michigan's 46th State House District here on the Left of Lansing podcast. Well, before you did decide to run for this seat, I mean, you have been active here for quite a while. Have you always, ever since you were younger, have you always had an interest in politics?
Yeah, I would say so. You know, I grew up like watching Donahue. And my sister is Well, she's in her 60s, her late 60s. So she was 20 years older than me. And she had been very involved in the civil rights movement and the women's movement. So I learned a lot about politics from my sister as well. So she was like a sister slash mother figure because she was old enough to be my mom, but she was cool enough to be my sister. But I did learn a lot of things from her. And yeah, I would say that I've always been interested in helping people, really. That's why I got my degree in psychology, and I got a master's degree in psychology too. And my work, my profession has always been centered around helping folks. I just would love to get to Lansing in order to be able to do that on a broader scale.
Would you say that there are some mental health issues that you would like to tackle if you got into the state legislature?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that our mental health system could definitely use a boost. I mean, people are constantly falling through the cracks and not getting the help they need, and sometimes can't afford to get the help they need, and their insurance doesn't always cover it, or maybe they don't even have insurance. I feel like there's a lot of work that we could be doing to help the mental health profession and help people that are suffering from depression or anxiety or whatever, a multitude of issues. And I feel like people need to have a place to go when they need help. And it shouldn't be something that is stigmatized. And I think that sometimes it is, and people are afraid to reach out for help. So I definitely think that there's a lot of things that we could do to improve our mental health system for sure. Accessibility and affordability and, just kind of making sure that people understand that mental health is a part of any physical health even. You know, if you don't have good mental health, it affects your physical health. I consider the two to be just as equally important.
Speaking with Jody LaMacchia, Democratic candidate for Michigan's 46th State House District here. Listen, Jody, before we go further, first of all, let me just say that I find it interesting that you're running for a State House seat, you know, during a time when politics is pretty boring right now. Not a whole lot going on, first of all.
It's just so dull.
But, of course, the big story this week is how Governor Whitmer said that bars and restaurants can reopen this week at half capacity. And, Jody, I was just wondering, how would you rate Governor Whitmer's performance at dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic? I mean, she had to withstand a barrage of attacks from Michigan's Republican leadership, right-wing groups, and, of course, the White House. How would you rate her performance?
I think she did an excellent job. I mean, she was just faced with a horrible situation that she didn't want to close down all of the businesses, obviously. No leader would want to harm businesses that are in their area, you know. So I do believe that it successfully flattened the curve. We are reopening now. I feel like the fact that she was so successful and she acted very quickly, shut down the state. And, you know, yeah, she took a lot of heat from businesses and different folks because obviously, you know, I mean, it was very stressful for like the small businesses in my district. I mean, I know some folks that closed their businesses. It's horrible that that happened. And I'm hoping now with the reopening of the restaurants and the bars and all of that, the stores, I hope that we have so many wonderful, like really thriving businesses in District 46. And a lot of them are just like baby businesses, you know, ones that have just opened. And they've managed to like persevere and be creative and still doing curbside and, you know, stores that kind of moved to online shopping. And so I hope that the lifting of this order helps all of these businesses to get on track and stay afloat because our downtowns in North Oakland and in District 46 are just they're so charming, and there's really unique stores and great restaurants and bars, and there's breweries and there's a distillery, and it's just really cool. You should come and check it out sometime. I mean, you know, in a lot of these places and a lot of the towns, you can just go from place to place to place and, you know, have dessert at this place or have dinner here or have a glass of wine at this wine bar, you know, go over here for an award-winning beer from, like, for instance, Homegrown Brewery. So, I mean, we have really thriving businesses. And so I'm really glad that they're reopening now so that hopefully they can pull out of this, because it's heartbreaking to see when businesses have to close. I'm sure that she didn't feel good about that either. But, you know, I do believe that it helped mitigate the spread of this disease. And I hope that with keeping the restaurants and everything at half capacity, that we still kind of are being safe and making sure that we still have to be really conscious of the fact that it's not gone. You know, it's still there, yeah. Some places. We still have to be really conscious of making sure that we're staying safe and distancing and just being really careful about that.
Absolutely. You know, that's something I have to agree with you about, is that my argument this whole time has been that the diminishing case and death numbers are proving that while maybe it did frustrate some people, her tactics did work, that she followed the science. I think she's vindicated.
I think so, too. I mean, I feel like ultimately we can't really have businesses operating if everybody is, you know, has coronavirus or everybody has died from coronavirus. I mean, okay, now we've got people on track. We've got people healthy. We have less people in the hospital with coronavirus. I think that we did a good job. And I think most people in Michigan took it seriously. And the reality is, even the polls show that most people support the governor's orders. Even people that I know, even small business owners in our district, supported the stay-at-home orders because, you know, they wanted to keep their clients and their customers healthy and themselves and their families too. You know, it really is like, yeah, you know, you want the businesses to succeed, but they can't succeed if everyone's sick.
That's another, thanks for bringing that up, because I've been arguing for the past 3 months ad nauseum, it seems like, especially with some on the right, that wouldn't it make more sense to ensure that you have as many healthy people as possible who can remain customers in the long run?
Right. I mean, if you're looking at it in a totally, like, your own perspective, yes. I mean, if you want customers, then you obviously want to make sure that they're safe and they're not catching this horrible disease. So, yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that she's been very steady at the wheel and hasn't gotten flustered by all of the noise and has just kind of focused and pushed forward and done the job that really she was supposed to do, you know, protect Michiganders. And now she's pivoting to keeping people safe, but also, hey, let's get the economy back and rolling as well. So I think she's done a great job.
Jody LaMacchia, Democratic candidate for Michigan's 46th State House District, is on the podcast here. Just have a couple of more minutes left because she's very, very busy, of course. You know, we've been talking here about how businesses, especially small businesses, have been affected by the shutdown. Of course, and it's not just in Michigan. I mean, this is all throughout the country. But still, we have to worry about, you know, your district and the state of Michigan. And I find it astounding that your Republican opponent, John Riley, I believe he does not really support Washington, D.C., or the Republicans in the Senate in Washington and President Trump enacting some type of bill to help bail out the states and then to help all, which would, you know, help bail us out all in general. I find that astounding. That is true, right? He doesn't think that Washington should bail us out.
Right. Yeah.
Unreal.
Well, he doesn't think, he signed on to a resolution that basically says the feds shouldn't help out the states that are, you know, in crisis. And so, I mean, those are our tax dollars, you know. we desperately need them because, I mean, I think what was the amount was like over the next couple of years, we're like $6 billion in the hole or something. And, you know, that's not even considering how in the hole we already were in terms of behind in education spending and behind in, you know, fixing our infrastructure and behind in, you know, money for the roads. And so we already needed a lot of revenue. And now we are so far in the hole. So we absolutely, that money is critical to keeping our state on track. I don't know what he thinks that, you know, what we could cut for $6 billion over the course of the next couple of years when we need funds so desperately to a lot of our programs already right now.
It just really is baffling that somebody, that he would take that kind of position. And
I know.
And let me argue, let me just pose this argument. Some would say that they support Republicans because of fiscal conservatism, but that's not fiscally conservative in my viewpoint. That's fiscally stupid. I would say the fiscally conservative, fiscally prudent thing to do is right now, as we are in the middle of a huge pandemic and we are also in the middle of kind of a minor depression, we need the federal government to do as much as it can to save the states, because the faster that we can lift the states up, the faster we'll be able to get out of this mess that we're in right now.
Absolutely. And I find it so interesting when we're so focused on fiscal conservatism after Washington passed tax cuts for the uber wealthy to the tune of however much that tax cut was, billions of dollars or whatever. And, you know, that was, nobody really balked at that, or I don't recall the conservatives, you know, balking at that. But when it comes to, hey, education is going to be really seriously hurt by the fact if we don't get these federal dollars. I mean, these things that are very important to our state and to our residents that live here, these are things that matter and require funding. And so, yeah, I think it would be a total disaster if we didn't get those federal dollars that we so desperately need. And a lot of most other states need it too. So, it's not just us alone, and I completely agree that the faster that we can get that help, the faster that we can get Michigan back on track, too.
It's this whole notion of, I don't know, and I don't understand it, to tell you the truth, because the numbers and the science don't back it up, but it's this notion of saving, burning the village in order to save it, viewpoint that some Republicans have that will never, ever make sense to me. You know, speaking of Representative Riley as well, is it true that he resisted having government require that landlords had to rent their properties to gay people? And is that true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he actually said at one of his coffee hours, well, he was asked about the Elliot, you know, expanding the Elliot Larson Act to apply to the LGBTQ community as well. And he said that he didn't support that. And then he also said that, and I believe this is pretty close to a direct quote, that he doesn't think that people should be forced to rent to them. So that's how he feels about that.
Okay, so there's another thing that I just don't get, because we want to make Michigan attractive for talented people to maybe want to move here and work here and thereby expanding our tax base. How would that viewpoint help in the long run? I would think it would hurt.
It does. It does hurt. And in fact, I mean, Crane's Business, you know, had a whole article about how extending protections to the LGBTQ community actually benefits businesses and makes for a more successful business environment. So it doesn't help. And I think that line of thinking is just so antiquated. It's run its course. I don't think most people are buying that. And in fact, I do live out here at an area where people, you know, consider it as being conservative. And I can tell you that even in, you know, conservative North Oakland, I guess, you know, maybe I've just been extraordinarily fortunate, but I would say I don't think that I've experienced any prejudice or, you know, intolerance out here. And, you know, I have a son, too, that's in high school. And everybody knows that I'm married to a woman and nobody cares. Like, nobody cares. I just don't know anybody that does. I mean, I guess there probably are some people that care somewhere, but I never heard from any of them. So I just think that, you know, I actually did a, I was invited to speak at a church last June over Pride Month. And the reality is, I think it's like 70% of people, some don't quote, well, I mean, here I am on a podcast saying this number, but I'm pretty sure that it's 70 some percent of people support, you know, the LGBTQ community having protections. This was, again, a Korean study that was in Crane's last year. And it was like, whether you're Catholic, whether you're Baptist, whether you're Republican, I mean, people support the LGBTQ community having protection. And so it's just, it's one of those things that I think he's on the wrong side of history. That viewpoint is history. It's not now, and it's not the future. It's a very small group of people that don't want everyone to have the same rights as everyone else. And but the majority of people do. So I think that he's in the minority on that one.
First of all, before you can even take on Representative John Riley, there is a primary. Are there others running for that seat on the Democratic side, or are you unopposed?
Nope, I'm unopposed. There's a lot of seats that are on the ballot that are completely just Republicans that are running up here. So, I mean, yeah, I don't have a, I don't have an opponent on the Dem side, which is great because this is a really tough seat to flip. It's no joke. And that was why I was the first candidate to file back in January of 2019. And so, we've just been very active on the ground and showing up in the community and just, you know, trying to live our values, which I think that as a state representative, you know, your constituents ought to know who you are and you ought to know who your constituents are. I don't believe most people know who John Riley is because he's not very accessible. I mean, even now with the coronavirus, he's not, I think he ordinarily has like a coffee hour a month. Now with the coronavirus, he's not having even those. You know, I just think that you should show up for things that matter to the people in your community, that you should care about the things that matter to the people in your district. And so that's really what we're trying to do, like me and my team and my campaign. I love that. That's my favorite part about running for office is actually showing up at the Elks Club and serving the veterans or doing the community cleanups. I mean, a lot of the things that we've been involved in over the last year and a half, we haven't been able to do as much anymore, obviously, but we've done can drives and we've participated in food drives with the UAW. One of them was recently, but we've, done a lot of things like that, like a lot of community outreach and trying to be involved with the community. And so I think it's been going pretty well. And fortunately, I do not have a Democratic opponent for the primary, so I can just focus entirely on flipping this seat.
Well, let me just say this, Jody, that it's great that you have decided to put your name in the ring and to go up against John Riley, because it's been my experience, especially in 2018, you know what? There are people, you're saying, you know, it's a Republican district, but maybe people are waiting for a voice, somebody who's sane and like you, and somebody who's got some good ideas like you, and somebody doesn't want this state to continue to veer off this right-wing ledge, that maybe they'd like to see it, you know, come back a bit, at least to the center, in your case. It reminds me of what Julia Pulver, a friend of this podcast, that's what she did. She ran in a Republican district and almost won a state Senate seat. And now she's running again for a state House seat. Yeah, that's right.
Yep.
She'll win this year. That's right.
Exactly.
And we're going to make sure that you do as well. Jody Lomakiev, a Democratic candidate for Michigan's 46th State House District. How do people contribute if they'd like to, or help volunteer with your campaign?
They can go to my website, which is Jody, J-O-D-Y, 2020.com. And, of course, I'm on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. But yeah, the best way to get involved with the campaign or to donate is to go to my website, jody2020.com.
Jody, thank you so very much for being on the Left of Lansing podcast, and I hope maybe we can catch back up maybe one more time in the fall.
That'd be great, Pat. I appreciate it. Thanks.
He loves Michigan snow, he loves Michigan beer, he loves Michigan's lakes, and he really loves Michigan sports teams once they start winning again. It's Pat Johnston on the Left of Lansing podcast. You can hear the podcast on Apple Music, Spotify, Google, and especially on leftoflansing.com.
Special thanks again to Jody LaMacchia for talking with me this week. That was a great conversation. I've linked to her campaign website along with this podcast, which you can find on leftoflansing.com. While southern Oakland County, yes, is turning more and more solid blue every day, northern Oakland County remains a bit more center-right. However, I do believe that Jody has a great chance at unseating her far right-wing opponent because John Riley is part of the Trump cult. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, John Riley represents yesterday's Michigan, while Jody LaMacchia represents today's Michigan. I refuse to believe that many in Michigan's 46th House District want to associate with yesterday's Michigan. Why? It's bad business. At a time when Michigan will need people not only to stay, but new people to move here, we can't have extreme elements of the right wing keeping Michigan stuck in the past. We can't have that. If we reinvest in our education system while at the same time exhibiting social tolerance, not only will a talented workforce stay here, but businesses will want to relocate here as well. Yes, that also means fixing the damn roads is just as crucial too. Again, Jody LaMacchia lives in a more conservative district, but as she said during our talk just moments ago, the residents in her district don't care that she's married to another woman. Why would they? We're no longer living in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, or 1950s, where the right could use gay rights as a wedge issue. We've moved on. We've progressed. That's how we become a more enlightened society, a more perfect union. Recently, Democratic State Representative and friend of the LOL podcast, Lori Pohutsky, tweeted a statement for Pride Month, and to celebrate how so many past leaders of the LGBT movement made it possible for her, a bisexual woman, to run and win a state house seat. But she also wrote that while those gains are to be celebrated, we cannot forget the grief and anger that Black Americans have and continue to experience on a daily basis. Representative Pohutsky from Livonia concluded by saying, after all, that's what pride is all about, the celebration of victories and the acknowledgement of continued struggles. Now, if you believe that's a common sense message, advocating for equality, then you're right. You're not wrong. It seems commonsensical. Yet that didn't prevent one right-winger from attacking Representative Pohutsky. The right-winger said that she didn't dare describe herself as a bisexual during the 2018 campaign and inferred that had she done so, she would have lost. Now, I'll give her credit. Representative Pohutsky responded to the crank. I would have just let it go, but she responded to the crank by saying that Michigan's right wing already ran a homophobic ad against her in 2018, showing her waving a bi flag. It didn't work then, and it won't work now. But, you know, this is why the right wing is losing elections across the country. Nobody cares. For somebody who always says, get government out of our lives, get government out of our lives, boy, they certainly want government in the lives of the LGBT community. And you know what? Here's the thing. Even if some of the LGBT community held some conservative ideas when it comes to granting massive tax breaks for rich people, let's say, they would never vote Republican because they know the Republican Party hates them. This country has not stopped moving forward when it comes to minority rights just because we have the current occupant in the White House. The fight continues, as we're seeing in streets across Michigan and across the country. For years, Republicans could count on dividing this country on union versus non-union, Black versus white, white versus Hispanics, men versus women, gay versus straight, and on and on and on. And it's been an effective tool. The Michiganders and the rest of the country are waking up to the fact that the ruling class is counting on us to fight amongst ourselves. As long as we remain divided, they remain in power, where they can call all the shots. They can continue to, for instance, redistribute wealth to the top, starve school districts, deregulate environmental measures, as Michigan did with the dams, and keep punitive economic and social inequality that hurts people of color. Oh, and they'll keep pushing to restrict voter participation as well. Thankfully, we stripped that power away from the hands of the DeVos family, the Michigan Chamber of Commerce, and its clueless leader, Rich Studley, by passing redistricting reform and voting rights ballot proposals back in 2018. You see, change can happen if we stick together. And that's the Left of Lansing Last Call.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you are hearing is by Wanderbeats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to my favorite progressive voice, Pat Johnston.
Well, that's going to do it for this installment of the Left of Lansing podcast. Remember, you can find me on Twitter at Left of Lansing. Also, don't forget, I keep all of the show archives and some of my other thoughts and opinions at leftoflansing.com. Please, everybody, keep your eye on the ball. Keep fighting for justice. Keep fighting for social justice. Keep fighting for health justice. And keep fighting for economic and environmental justice. There's so much going on, but we've just got to stay focused, because if we want the change, that will happen in the end at the ballot box. That's the only way it will change in the end. So as many of the people across the country have shown, and as thousands upon thousands have shown here in Michigan during the past few weeks, all we have to do is keep taking the battle to them. Keep wearing your masks, and thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston. Just kidding, this thing isn't researched. And broadcasted by Pat Johnston. Technical assistance provided by the wonderful Dr. Heather. And don't forget to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information and Pat's musical taste, if you can handle it. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.